From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back in Park City talking about another film at Sundance. The director Stanley Nelson will join us to discuss his epic documentary about Miles Davis. Davis was brilliant, of course, but he could be cold and vain and callous and mean. And there were reasons for that. Nelson explores them in the film. He calls Miles Davis the very embodiment of cool. We'll be right back.
Take KUER wherever you go with our mobile app. Listen to a live stream of the station, get the latest stories from NPR and the KUER newsroom, or explore the newest Radio West podcast. You can even access our 24/7 streams of classical music and the BBC. It's not just any app. It's the KUER app, available for Android and iPhone wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Two things most people know about Miles Davis: that he was a musical genius and that he was mean, or at least seemed that way, angry and intense. In Stanley Nelson's new documentary, one of his friends says Miles didn't care. He didn't have to please anybody but Miles. But the film is about his life, and it explains why he felt that way. He was, he said, protecting himself and his emotions. One of the writers featured in the film says his personality quirks, the anger, the antisocial behavior, those demons, she said, are the very things that are the basis of art. So for Miles Davis, art, she said, became a way of healing. His style, which changed the world of music forever, was the way he could reveal a side of him that in the real world he just couldn't show. Today in the program, we're continuing our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're back in Park City at community radio station KPCW, and the filmmaker Stanley Nelson is with us. His film is called Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. It's in the documentary premieres section at Sundance. Nelson directed and produced the film. It's the 10th, by the way, that he's shown at the Sundance Film Festival. We'll give you details about where you can see the film a little bit later in the program. But Stanley Nelson, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Did you ever meet Miles Davis?
No, never met him. I actually heard him a couple of times live, but never was kind of in that rarefied air to meet Miles.
But you heard him live?
Yeah, I did.
And what was that like? I mean, because here's the question that I'm getting at. Like, were you a fan, and does it make it more difficult or easier to make a film about someone that you're a fan of?
I've been a fan of Miles Davis all my life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it feels like you have this weight on your shoulder, you know, of trying to make a film about somebody who you love and somebody who I feel, you know, is an undoubted genius. So that makes it kind of difficult.
Did you ever find yourself along the way wanting to protect him in some way or defend him in some way?
I think maybe a little bit, but I want to make sure that I didn't go there. You know, it was really important that we made this film, you know, warts and all. I mean, part of the trick with the film is that, you know, you want to talk about his personality, as somebody says, his personality quirks, you know, he had a lot of them. But you know, you also want to make sure that we talk about the music and that it not overwhelm the music that he created. That part of the mystery of Miles, and part of the reason why I wanted to make the film, is, you know, as his ex-wife Frances Davis says at the end of the film, you know, how could somebody who could make such beautiful music also have this other side? And that was something that we wanted to investigate.
Well, that was one of the things he said, that yes, he could be intense, and he had that, you know, he was known for all of that, but he was good at what he did. And that was important to him, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes people don't understand, you know, how important Miles's music was to him, you know, because there's this sense of jazz musicians, unfortunately, that, you know, they just get up on the stage and play, and, you know, they don't practice and they just play and walk away. But, you know, we wanted to to give you a sense of how complicated this music is. You know, as somebody says, they were sound physicists, you know, we wanted to give you that idea and how important this music was to Miles, and how important that it was performed well was to Miles. You know, there's a lot of people see and think about Miles later on in life that, you know, he doesn't show up or whatever. You know, I actually went to a concert of Miles where he refused to come on and play because his instruments hadn't arrived from Japan or wherever, you know, the electric instruments. And, you know, they were like, just go on. Yeah, we'll go on and play with what you've got, or we'll get you new instruments. He's like, nah, I'm not going on. You know, I don't have the proper equipment. I'm not gonna do it. Wow. So music was really important to Miles, and how he sounded on stage was really important, and the audience was really important. I mean, it's this weird thing because the audience is really important, but then he's not gonna change for the audience.
Yeah,
you know, he was gonna do his music the best he could to the highest level, but if you didn't get it, you know, that's your problem.
Right. Let's talk about Miles' voice. We hear an actor, Carl Lumley, read. He's terrific, by the way.
Thanks.
Talk a little bit about that, because I guess one of the choices you could have made was find stuff from interviews he had done. But the way you did it was have Miles himself kind of narrate the piece.
Yeah, we really wanted that to happen. What really happened was that we started out the film, and Quincy Troop, who co-wrote Miles' autobiography with Miles, the way they did that was he would sit down with a tape recorder, a little old cassette tape recorder, and just talk to Miles, you know, at length. And we got from Quincy 55 tapes, Quincy 55 cassette tapes,
wow,
of Miles being interviewed. And we struggled for a long time to actually use those tapes and to use Miles's voice. But the tape quality was so bad. And they weren't made for that. They were just made for, you know, to record Miles' voice so that Miles would be eating a hamburger, you know, while he was talking, or the TV would be on in the background and stuff. And it just became, you know, we realized this is just really limiting us and is going to be impossible. So then we went to his autobiography. And we used his autobiography, and we got the actor Carl Lumley to come in and kind of quote from the autobiography. And of course, you know, Miles had that voice, that distinctive voice. And so we had him read it in Miles's voice, and that was really hard because, you know, we had to, you know, it's hard to do that for a whole film to make that consistent. But, you know, that was Miles. But also, you know, one of the things that we did was the first couple of times during interviews, when people would kind of quote Miles, they would just naturally go into his voice, you know, like, you know, Miles said, just play, you know, and so they would naturally do that. So then we started asking people, you know, so if you do quote Miles, or you do tell us something that Miles said, you know, please do it in his voice, because so many people did it naturally.
Yeah. Well, let's give people a chance to hear Carl Lumley reading as Miles Davis. This is something, Stanley, I wanted to ask you about, because I have to say, it comes in the film quite early on, and it's just a brief moment here, but it was something that helped me understand him really well. Let me play this moment from the film.
Living is an adventure and a challenge. It wasn't about standing still and becoming safe. But I've always been the way I am, been like this all my life. If anybody wants to keep creating, they have to be about change.
Have to be about change.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to exactly explain his life. He didn't want to stop. He wanted to keep moving. He was never satisfied with the thing he did in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's even one. I don't think Miles could stop. I mean, he just had to constantly change and reinvent himself. But that was Miles. You know, he constantly changed. You know, he changed jazz music, you know, four or five times, you know, during his life. You know, was so influential in so many other types of music. So, you know, that comes really early on in the film. It's one of the first things you hear, because that's who Miles was.
And
we wanted to set up that this is Miles' story, this story of constant change and reinvention.
What did he mean when he said music has always been a curse for him?
I think he means that, you know, it consumes him. And I think he understood later on in life that it was to the detriment of his own personal relationships, the detriment of his relationships with his kids, with women, with other musicians, you know, with being normal, you know. Yeah. I mean, Miles, it was, as someone says, it was all about the music. Music was everything. That's what it was all about to Miles.
He was born in Illinois, but his father moved him to East St. Louis. Talk a little bit about what it was like there, because this seems like his, you know, his father was wealthy and successful, but as you mentioned in the film, that didn't protect him from the racism and segregation of the day. So what influence did that have on him, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. It's really important that Miles was wealthy. His father was a dentist, as someone says. He was the second richest black man in the state of Illinois. Miles grew up, you know, in the city of East St. Louis, but they had a farm outside of East St. Louis. Miles had a horse, you know, all his life. This was how Miles grew up. But, you know, East St. Louis is in the South. I mean, basically, you're growing up in the South. He was born in 1926 during the, you know, height of segregation. And this is what Miles saw. You know, one of the first quotes in the film from Miles is that, you know, the white folks in East St. Louis were racist to the bone. And that's what Miles saw. And as someone says, again, it didn't protect him. You know, being rich, a rich black person didn't protect you. There was no protection from the racism of East St. Louis and the racism of, frankly, the United States. And this is something that Miles sees and endures and reacts to over and over again for the rest of his life.
There's another element that it comes early in the film that helped me understand a little bit about, you know, Miles' kind of attitude. I mean, clearly there was defiance in there, some pride related to how he and other African Americans had been treated. But there was also a kind of rage or anger that seems to have come from what he saw in his parents' relationship. He talked about how his parents were at each other's throats since he was a child. I want to ask you about that. Let me play a moment from the film. A childhood friend is in this clip, Lee Annie Bonner. We also hear from Quincy Troop, who you mentioned, a friend, and helped him write his autobiography. And then we'll hear, of course, Miles, voiced by Carl Lumley.
They had been at each other's throats since I was a little kid.
He would hear his mother and father just talking and fussing. And so I guess this is what got in his mind as a young boy.
Miles absorbed that. He absorbed all of that, the anger, that kind of attitude toward women.
I remember my mother picking up things and throwing them at my father. He got so mad with her, he punched her. He knocked a couple of teeth right out of her mouth. It had to affect us somehow, although I don't really know how.
It's interesting. What effect do you figure that had on his treatment of women? If I don't know, I don't want to psychoanalyze him, but what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, we try not to do that too much in the film, but I think it's important that this is what he saw. You know, different people react to different stimuli in different ways,
yeah.
You know, but this is what Miles saw. And Miles was, you know, in turn abusive to women, you know, and you know, but Miles also needed women, you know. I mean, you know, the women that Miles was close to all his life, you know, they were not in the kind of drug life that consumed him. They were anchors for Miles that tended to be, you know, what he wanted from women. And you know, his relationship with Frances, which was probably his most lasting and deepest, you know, in some ways he recognized was a tragedy. You know, he recognized that he messed up something that didn't need to be messed up.
Yeah. Frances is great, by the way.
She's incredible.
What's so great about her is she's just, she's super confident. You know, she's constantly reminding people she had the best legs in the business. She's really great.
Yeah, Frances was incredible. Frances, I you know, passed away right after Thanksgiving of this year and didn't see the film. I'm so sad about that. But Frances, we've dedicated the two showings that we've had here at Sundance to Frances. Mm. She's just, somebody asked me to describe Frances, and I was like, she's a trip. I don't know how to describe Frances. You know, because look, Frances was, you know, undoubtedly, you know, one of the most beautiful women in the world. I mean, when you see her, she's just stunningly beautiful. And, I mean, it's like she looks like a doll or something, like somebody created her.
And those two together.
They're incredible together. But also she's like so funny, you know, and she it's almost like she's pulling your leg the whole time she's talking to you, you know. Like she's just great.
Yeah, she really is. You know, there's a childhood friend who mentions in the film that Miles would go out into the woods and play what he was hearing from nature, like the birds. What did that tell you about the way he thought about music? Or, I mean, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and Miles is just such an interesting character, and you know, you start to feel that you know, music was something different to him than it is. You know, I was just talking to my daughter the other day, and she was just reading me this list. I forgot what it's called. People who hear music, who see colors as music.
Oh, yeah. You know? What is it called?
Yeah, and she was, I mean, and the list of famous musicians who have that thing, you know, is like super long. I don't know if Miles had it, but, you know, it's that music means something. Music meant something different to him. It was just so much more important.
Is it synesthesia?
Yeah. Yeah. It's where, you know, your senses confuse things. And you know, so many people who have that become musicians. I think for Miles, you know, it was something different. As this same person says, you know, Miles was, he was thought of as a genius in East St. Louis when he was still a kid. You know, he's a kid. And people already realized that he was a genius on the trumpet.
Let's talk about this critical moment in Miles' early life. I think he's 18. He's just graduated from high school, and he gets this chance to be in this kind of popular dance band. And let me play this moment. This is Ashley Kahn, the writer, music writer. He talks about in the film how this experience really kind of altered his life, changed his life.
So the real pivot point for Miles is when, during his summer after high school, he is invited to sit in with the Billy Eckstine band.
When that rhythm's in you, the blues don't have a chance.
Both Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie are in that band. I mean, you've got the laboratory, the future of modern jazz right there in this big band.
The greatest feeling I ever had in my life with my clothes on was when I first met Diz and Bird. I was 18 years old. I decided right then and there I had to be in New York on 52nd Street, where the action was.
What was going on in 52nd Street? What was the music scene there that he was taking in?
Yeah, 52nd Street during this period was just this. There's never been anything like it. I mean, there were, I don't know how many jazz clubs on 52nd Street, you know, I don't know, 10 or 20 jazz clubs, like back to back to back to back.
Both
sides of the street. I mean, the pictures are just crazy. You're like, what? You know? And, you know, and I it wasn't a lot of money to get in. And you know, all the jazz musicians are there. They have speakers outside so you can kind of hear the music. And you can hear what's going on inside. And it was just a hotbed where this new musical form that's bebop was really taking shape, and Miles is right in the middle of this. And this is, you know, I mean, for those, you know, who don't know, I mean, so what was happening before that was the big band, the swing era, where you had those huge bands, you know, Tommy Dorsey and Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and all of a sudden there were these small groups, these, you know, four or five person group, and playing this different kind of music that had this incredible energy in it, and that was, you know, some of the most complicated music ever invented. And Miles, you know, follows Dizzy and Charlie Parker to New York to be part of this 52nd Street a scene.
You mentioned something that the writer Greg Tate talks about in the film, how they were sound physicists, like working out this music. And it was research and development. I mean, I really like the way he explained it like that. that because there was such complexity and such brilliance to the way they were working out that music.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that was being invented like on the spot, you know, every night, this new kind of music. I mean, it's so much of the music that we think of as modern jazz kind of came out of what happened on 52nd Street. And Miles, again, you know, just like falls into it as an 18-year-old at this pivotal time. And it shapes him for the rest of his life.
You also explain how black musicians at the time were on 52nd Street. They wanted to be taken seriously. They didn't want to be part of these minstrel shows. Like, they wanted to be taken seriously. And so the way they dressed, the way they carried themselves, that was important.
Yeah, they did not perform. You know, as Quincy Jones, who's in the film, says, you know, they there was none of that. They wanted to be taken seriously, like Stravinsky. That's what they wanted. Yeah. I mean, that's how they saw themselves. You know, they were serious musicians. I mean, they did not. They, you know, and it was kind of like, you know, if you could understand the music, you liked it, then come on in. If you didn't, then sorry. You know, they yeah. made no concessions. They just played this, you know, wild, free music, you know, on a night after night, and just went further and further out. You know, and it was up to you to join in, and which is different from so much of the of what we had seen in black music, where there was a real kind of performing for the audience. You know,
trying to please.
Yeah, I mean, you even see it in a great musician like Louis Armstrong. You know, who did that? Who, you know, is one of the greatest musicians, you know, in the history of jazz, but also would kind of perform for the audience. You know, in some ways, you know, this music that's being invented and carries Miles through the rest of his life, this attitude of, I am not going to perform for you. My performance is the music. And if you come in here, then you've come in to see and hear the music, and that's it.
Yeah. One of the things you also explore in the film is how Miles managed to take those influences of that organic jazz he's hearing on 52nd Street, but then also work in the music of these classically trained composers and how he was able to put this together. Let me play another moment from the film. We'll hear Quincy Troupe here, and then the Columbia professor Farrah Griffin, and Jimmy Cobb, the musician Jimmy Cobb.
Miles enrolled in Juilliard because he wanted to learn music and because his mother wanted him to be a trained musician and all of that.
He is serious about Juilliard. He's seriously committed to it, and he values what Juilliard might have to offer.
A lot of the old guys thought that if you went to school, it would make you play like you were white. If you learned something from theory, you would lose the feeling in your playing. I would go to the library and borrow scores by all of those great composers. I wanted to see what was going on in all of music.
And yet he knows that there's something else going on. It's not happening at Juilliard.
So he used to go at Juilliard in the daytime, and at night, he'd be on 52nd Street.
So he must have worked really hard. I mean, some of the photos that we see give that sense that he was studying and studying. I mean, he was, again, he wasn't just going up on the stage and working this stuff out. He really had to figure it out first.
Yeah, I mean, what he was doing was just incredible. I mean, you know, he was going to Juilliard in the day, and then he would play at night and go to clubs at night to listen to bebop. But then he would also take classical scores out of the library there at Juilliard, and then he would go home and study that all night and bring other jazz musicians and look at that and talk about theory and deal with that and then, you know, get up in the morning again and go back to Juilliard during the day. So, you know, what he was doing at that point was just incredible.
I want to play a story told by Wayne Shorter. I want to just play this moment and ask you about it, because I think it's kind of telling. Here's Quincy Troupe and Wayne Shorter.
One day, the teacher said the blues grew out of the downtrodden sufferings of the slaves of slavery and the crying and wailing and all that. This became the blues of the people in chains and all that. Miles is in the back of the room somewhere, and he raised his hand while she was talking. And she said, yes? He said, you a goddamn liar. and walked out of the room.
What did he mean?
I think she's saying that the music grew out of this suffering, and you know, and I think Miles is like, no, you know, this music grew out of the joy, the joy of being black, a lot of it, you know, the joy of being alive, the joy of being, you know, who we are. I think that's, you know, and Miles is like, no, you know, and I think there, you know, there was a feeling that people were teaching stuff that they didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, and he could go down to 52nd Street and, you know, learn from, you know, Dizzy and Charlie Parker, from people who knew, you know, who definitely knew.
At what point, Stanley, do you think he figures out his own style? When does that kind of start to coalesce, do you think?
I think it coalesces right here. You know, he drops out of Juilliard. He's now, you know, just ensconced with Charlie Parker. Dizzy Gillespie leaves and Charlie Parker. So Charlie Parker hires Miles as the trumpeter. But Miles couldn't play as fast as Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, he could. I actually believe that he could, because there's some things where you actually hear where he could do that. But I don't think he wanted to. I think he realized. Mm-hmm. I mean, Miles was really, you know, he not only being a genius and good, Miles was slick. I mean, Miles understood what people wanted to hear.
Yeah.
You know, and Miles, and one thing they say is that, it's a kind of interesting point, I don't know if it's true or not, is that, you know, that bebop, you know, when they're playing really fast, really fast, really fast, it's like a really masculine music. You know, and women didn't want to hear that, you know, and it was a little bit too much, and it was too much for so many people. And Miles says, wait a minute, you know, there's something, maybe I can kind of meld these things from Juilliard, and then I'm here on 52nd Street, and slow this thing down a little bit, and you know, and let it breathe, you know, and he becomes, you know, at that point, Miles Davis.
Yeah. He loves a good melody, you talk about in the film. And then he builds on it and he works through it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Miles, one of the things about Miles is he was not afraid of silence. You know, he's not afraid of silence in his music. He was not afraid to take, you know, a ballad and look for what the heart of that ballad is. You know, like what is this song really about?
Yeah.
You know, and you can feel it, you know, coming through that trumpet and you know, and that was one of the gifts that Miles had.
Here's another moment from the film. This is the writer Greg Tate talking about what was different about this music. He hooks up with Gil Evans and the influence that they have together and the music they're trying to make.
And right now, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you something new in modern music. Impressions in Modern Music with the great Miles Davis and his wonderful new organization.
I think the intention was to create a listening music, a concert music that very deliberately did not have the drive and the funk of 52nd Street on it. But it's mainly about trying to create new colors in a way where you widen the palette of jazz. And I think he was conscious of the fact that to move the music forward, you've got to go someplace it hasn't gone before.
Let's talk about Paris. Uh-huh. Paris seemed to change him. And we'll get to this, how he gets just utterly depressed when he has to come back home. But he loved everything about Paris. Why?
I mean, you know, Miles had never been abroad before, and he goes to Paris in 1949 with this group of musicians. It's actually like a whole jazz show. They bring a whole bunch of people over there, and Miles had never been out of the country before. And you know, I mean, it was like Paris, like was like for him getting hit with a baseball bat. I mean, it was different. I mean, yeah. You know, and somebody says, you know, it's just different for you know. African Americans and also especially jazz musicians, where all of a sudden, you know, jazz is the height of music in Paris. He's meeting all these famous people. You know, he's revered in Paris in a very different way. And, you know, I mean, look, you know, Europe and Paris and, you know, has its own problems, you know, but the racism in the way it's projected in the United States is very different.
Yeah.
In Paris. There's a layer that's just not there. And Miles, for the first time, sees this and just, you know, falls in love, you know, literally and figuratively with Paris.
It has an affair with a woman there, of course. He falls in love. But as you say, I think this gives him a perception of himself that you wouldn't. I think a black man from where he was couldn't have that growing up in America. As you say, that layer of racism was gone, and it seemed to kind of inspire him in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, look, Miles had a high opinion of himself throughout his life and even before that. But I think it raises the bar. You know, these people look at him as the height of, you know, intellects, you know, and Miles, and this music is great. And so Miles, you know, Miles sees the horizons for his music become even greater. It's like, okay, this, you know, this is these people in Paris are seeing this music as you know, the greatest thing that's being created today, you know, is jazz. And so, you know, he kind of looks at that, and for the rest of his life, he's striving to attain that. You know, this is not just, you know, me, you know, riffing off something in a club. This is great music, and I want it to be that.
Yeah. He said that the time he was there, he called it this illusion of possibility.
Right.
And then it cracks when he has to go back home. Talk a little bit about when he has to leave, because this, as you explore in the film, really throws him into his first big downward spiral. I mean, he has a few of these in his life, but this is the first one.
Yeah, Miles almost stays in Paris. Kenny Clarke, who goes there with him, says, "I'm not leaving, man. I'm staying. You know, you should stay." Yeah. Juliette Greco, who he is in love with, you know, they say, you know, "You guys should just get married and you should stay." And he decides, you know, that the States is really where his life is, and he's gonna leave, and he comes back to the United States, and as he says, you know, it hit him, you know, like he didn't have any idea that it would hit him like it does. And he spirals into drug addiction. And you know, drug addiction was something that was very, you know, part of the jazz scene at that point. But Miles had avoided using heroin up until that point. But he falls into heroin and becomes deeply, deeply addicted. I mean, you know, for years. I mean, you know, 3 or 4 years. It's not that it's like he dabbles in drugs for a minute. He's shooting up heroin, you know, for years. And that's who he is. You know, he was there. You know, he can't make any money. He's undependable. People are like, you know, "Don't hire Miles, you know, because he's not going to show up." And, you know, I forgot which musician it is, lets him, you know, into his room to sleep it off, and goes out, and Miles steals his clothes and goes, you know, and hocks his clothes. I mean, Miles was rough. I mean, he was really bad off.
We get to this point where his father comes and gets him.
Right.
Takes him back home. And the story that you mentioned in the documentary, basically I'm not sure how, couldn't have been easy, but he works himself through that withdrawal. It basically cleans himself up.
Yeah, he goes to his father's farm finally. I mean, he's in East St. Louis using drugs for a while. And finally he goes to the farm and just kind of locks himself in the farm for a couple of weeks and kicks drugs and kicks heroin, you know, which is a very difficult thing to do and to stick with, but he does. And from that point, he never seriously uses heroin again for the rest of his life.
The Newport Jazz Festival. This is another really critical moment as he digs himself out of that hole. Talk about what Newport meant for him as an opportunity, because this was big.
Yeah, so Miles comes back, but, you know, there's still this stigma attached to Miles. You know, "Don't hire Miles. He's a drug addict. You know, don't do Miles." And he convinces George Wein, the producer of the Newport Jazz Festival, to let him play. And he literally, you know, says, you know, you got to have me on the jazz festival. The slate is all set. They've already got a slate. And but George Green says, okay, you can play. And they put together this group, and Miles, you know, is there to play in the group. And he realizes how important this is. He realizes that this is his shot to come back. And, you know, one thing that I love about Miles is when he gets a shot any time in his life, you know, he goes for it.
Yeah.
You know, he's not playing, you know. And so he gets this shot to come back and gives this just incredible performance of Round Midnight, Monk's brilliant tune. And that changes everything for him.
Here's another moment for the film. You hear George Ween here.
Miles put the bell of his horn right into the microphone and changed the whole world of jazz right there, and changed his career right there. Because the beauty of that song and the beauty of Miles's trumpet made bebop a music that could be accepted by everybody. They could now put on Miles' music while they were making love.
Davis, of course. We're talking with Stanley Nelson. This film is Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. It's screening in the documentary premieres section at the Sundance Film Festival. The film is screening tomorrow at 2:30 at the Mark Theater in Park City, and again on Saturday evening at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back in Park City in the studios of community radio station KPCW as we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. Stanley Nelson is with us talking about Miles Davis. His documentary is about this enigmatic, complicated, difficult man and about how he came to develop this style of jazz music that was his own, organically his, and how he changed the world of music forever. It's called Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. There are a number of screening opportunities we'll tell you about a little bit later on the program. I'm glad you talked about how his voice ended up the way it did. Just talk a little. This was in 1956. He has this growth removed. And he's supposed to take care of himself, but he just can't help himself, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my understanding is it's a simple operation. You know, he just has to get a polyps, I think it is, removed from his throat. And then he can't talk for 2 weeks. He has to be quiet for 2 weeks. And, you know, he gets mad at somebody and starts yelling and screaming. And that was it. He scarred his throat and, you know, he never got his voice back. And so, you know, he has this voice like that, that is, you know, his signature for the rest of his life, and that's just how he sounded, and that's real.
It's interesting. There's also the story of when he first appears on stage with that voice, and the audience starts to laugh.
Yeah, I thought that was really significant, you know. So, you know, he right after he has the operation, he gets that rasp in his voice, and he's appearing, and we have someone who's at this appearance, and she says, you know, he gets on stage, and he starts talking, and he's introducing a song, and the audience doesn't know that he's had the operation, doesn't know his voice is damaged, and they start to laugh at him. And he, like, gives the audience this weird look and then just walks off the stage. And in the film, that leads to the next section where we talk about Miles turning his back on the audience, because I think those two things are kind of connected.
Yeah, for sure. It wasn't – I think I've heard a lot about that, that he would hardly look at the audience sometimes. Like, he was like – and it looked like – it seemed like disdain, but that's not really what it was, although in some ways there was some defiance there, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what Miles always said, and he says in the film, is that, you know, he's really communicating with the band. And that's what he's doing, and that's what he needs to do to play the best music he can, is to communicate with the band. As Miles once said, you know, when Leonard Bernstein conducts a band, he's facing the band. He's got his back to the audience. You don't expect him to face the audience and put on a show of conducting. He's conducting the band. And Miles said that he needed to face the band, you know, to have this interplay that is the heart of jazz. So that's what Miles said.
Yeah. Well, we have to talk about Kind of Blue.
Okay.
What does that album mean to you before we talk about Miles? Because it means a lot of things to a lot of people.
I mean, you know, I think without a doubt, Kind of Blue is one of the greatest albums ever recorded in any idiom. It is just an amazing, amazing piece of work. It does that thing that classics do, is you know, it lets you in. You know, and at the same time, it's very complicated. It makes you feel smarter than you are. You know, when you listen to it, you're like, damn, I get this. Oh, wow. You know, it's just an amazing, amazing piece of work. When I went to college, I stole my father's copy of Kind of Blue and took his vinyl copy with me to college and, you know, had a copy of Kind of Blue with me in some way or other ever since. It's just an amazing piece of work. And as someone says in the film, you know, it changed jazz, and it's I don't know, it's just beautiful, and it's the height of this kind of you know, spontaneous creativity that is jazz. You know, what can you say about it?
Yeah,
it's just a beautiful, amazing, amazing piece of work that you know, it's like a concept album before we even had concept album. I mean, the album is all tied together in some strange way. It just sounds like, you know, the same thing. It's an amazing, amazing piece of work.
Well, and the way you tell the story of Kind of Blue is so lyrical and beautiful. Like, it's my favorite section of the film, I think, almost.
Thank you. It's a place where we really wanted to let the music live and breathe. You know, we found this incredible performance of So What from Kind of Blue. It's just a beautiful, beautifully shot piece, and where they're actually playing live, you know, in a TV station with four or five cameras. It's just a great piece.
It's great. It's so great to see Miles in the background when someone else is playing or others watching. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's my favorite. Shot where I think Coltrane is playing, you see Miles and the rest of the people just grooving, you know, they're just standing there grooving on Coltrane. It's just such a beautiful piece. It was really important to us to let the music sing there. I mean, you know, Kind of Blue is like, for me, it's like, I wish I didn't know I wish I could discover Kind of Blue. I mean, so for everybody who hasn't heard Kind of Blue, you know, get a copy somewhere and put it on. Because, I mean, just the fact of being able to discover this piece of music, it'll make you feel better. It makes you feel better about yourself. And that's an amazing thing to do.
And it's amazing. He didn't write out the music. He didn't have sheet music. He had these notes and he had these sketches. Here's a moment from the film. You're going to hear Jimmy Cobb, who was on drums in that session. Miles, of course, you'll hear. The musician Marcus Miller and Joshua Redmond from the film, Miles Davis.
He just came in with little notes that he had. He didn't even have sheet music for that. And the only thing he told me was, like, just swing, you know? He says, just swing.
I didn't write out the music for Kind of Blue.
but brought in sketches because I wanted a lot of spontaneity in the playing. I knew that if you've got some great musicians, they will deal with the situation and play beyond what is there and above where they think they can.
The first part of So What? Do boom bang, dum boom boom, do do dee do do la 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 la, do dee do 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 do. Then Paul go into the bass saying, boo doo boo doo boo dee boo doo.
Dee doo, boom 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 boom. Man, that was the first thing I ever heard from Miles. Grabbed the record out of my father's record collection, put it on. First thing that catches your ear is Paul Chambers playing that bass line.
We can't even question the sacred text that we have, right? Like, you know, I mean, why is the Bible the Bible? It's the Bible, you know? I mean, why is Kind of Blue Kind of Blue? It's kind of blue. Like, it just is, and it changed the sound of jazz.
How did it change his life, that album?
You know, Kind of Blue is the best-selling jazz album of all times. You know, that's what it is, you know. And so for Miles, all of a sudden, if someone says he's in music maestro land, this album is what made him, you know, an icon. It made him, beyond being this great musician, he became something different. It was like the Miles Davis mystique, as someone says. You know, he has, Ferraris, he's getting his suits tailor-made.
Yep.
He's like the hippest thing since sliced bread. He is the birth of the cool. He's the coolest man on earth. And so it changed his life forever. But what also is really important about it is, you know, he played Kind of Blue in clubs and concerts, you know, for a year, and then he moved on.
Yeah.
I mean, that was Miles.
But that's the thing, right? I mean, that is and I think people might have been frustrated by that, you know, he didn't want to play the old stuff. He wanted to, as we talked about earlier, change was important for him.
Yeah, I mean, change was everything for Miles. And I think that one of the things that's so funny is people talk about, you know, later on in life, you know, when Miles goes into the electric period, they're like, oh, you know, that's really commercial. Well, you know, Miles could have played Kind of Blue like for the rest of his life and sold out clubs and concerts. He could have done that for the rest of his life and been a very rich man and with little effort. You know, could have come out and done his thing and you know, gone off stage. But Miles didn't want to do that. Miles wanted to keep creating and had to keep changing.
Yeah. There's a moment in that later period that you're exploring. Carlos Santana says that it was kind of like acid music, you know, Bitches Brew and that music that he's developing after that. And we'll hear in this clip Quincy Troupe and Stanley Crouch, who didn't like it, that those later phases. But as Greg Tate mentions also in this moment, he's creating this template for modern music. So he didn't just rest on his laurels with Kind of Blue. Here's another moment from the film.
Miles' audience was changing because his music was changing, absorbing what was happening now. What was happening now, not 10 years ago, now.
I never understood what was so appealing to so many people. And I was trying to figure out what year it did. I didn't understand it. Plus, it didn't sound good.
People who say that, I just always looked at them like, you're really ignorant, and what drove you to say that is because you're jealous, because you could never be or have or even comprehend something that is beyond your limited, twisted, crooked mind. Damn, Carlos, that's a little harsh, but it's accurate.
When you listen to that slew of records, you know, he made in rapid succession, about 69 through 75, I mean, you hear the template for hip-hop, for house, drum and bass, electronica. Miles was doing all of that in the early 70s. He's creating new music, and kind of disturbing the fabric.
Stanley, how do you think about his last years of his life? Do you see them as tragic or sad, or what do you see in those last moments?
No, I mean, I think, you know, there's the music that we just heard, which we really wanted to make sure we talked about in the film, because, you know, so many people don't like it and some people love it, but we wanted to make sure we talked about it because it did once again change music. I mean, yeah. He invented the idea of fusion. So we really wanted to talk about it, you know, and then he goes into this dark period and where he doesn't play for 6-7 years. But then he comes back.
Yeah.
You know, he comes back. He comes back with a vengeance. He comes back, you know, and wins Grammys and does Tutu.
And does starts doing interviews.
Yeah, and he's a different person.
Yeah.
He's on TV, you know, he's acting in movies. It's crazy. He's just a different person. And there's a great clip that we love where he's playing with Prince.
Yeah.
You know, he's performing with Prince and stuff. It's a great, great clip. I think his down period, what they call it, the hiatus between 75 and 81, yeah, is tragic. But as somebody said, you know, he's been doing this for like 30, 40 years, you know, at the top level. And, you know, it's okay to be tired, you know, and he was tired. But he does come back, and he comes back with a vengeance, and, you know, was out there playing, you know, almost to the last minute of his life.
Stanley Nelson, his film is Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. It's screening in the documentary premiere section at Sundance this year. You can see it tomorrow at 2:30 at the Mark Theater in Park City. There's also a screening on Saturday afternoon in Salt Lake City at the Broadway Center Cinemas. More information about that on our website, radiowest.org. Stanley Nelson, thank you again for being with us.
That was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Thanks to Renee Bodley, Bob Hendricks, Scott Matthews of KPCW here in Park City. Our program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.